Hello, everybody. It has been a hot minute, but we are back for season 6, episode 1 of Mind Clickers, where it's time to click both heads in 2025. Today, I have the absolute pleasure to jump on and have a pretty good and pretty interesting chat about esports and AI, everything AI, with Chris Smith, someone who's worn every hat in gaming in the esports world, from semi-pro gamer to commentator and agency founder. With over 15 years of experience at the cutting edge of marketing and gaming, he's now leading the charge into the future with a big R, an AI-driven platform set to revolutionize social media for small businesses. How are you going this morning, brother?
And cold in Melbourne, but good. Good
overall. Always cold. We love a bit of cold weather, but I used to be a really cold fiend, but now I feel like, I don't know, in the morning it's really hard to get up, so it's been a bit of a struggle recently.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a cricket nuffy. I play cricket in the summer and I also play it in the winter. And cricket in the winter, catching a hard ball on cold hands is terrible.
Oh, I could not imagine.
The only savior is hot hands, which is what the esports pros use these days too, which I wish I used when I was trying to go pro back in the day. Yeah, try to stuff them in your pockets. And I haven't yet had to dive onto a ball and had one explode in my pants, but I'm not looking forward to that because I don't know what it's going to be, like chemical burns on my legs, who knows, but it's worth it for the warm hands.
Yeah, absolutely. We used to have them on stage at LANs. And I remember I just used to have them in my pocket. And even after like 15 minutes, it gets super hot. So be careful with those. Beautiful. But yeah, usually on Mind Clickers, we usually start off, as many of the listeners know, with a bit of an overview, a background, an insight into your journey, into your world. So take us through it from start to finish, I guess, how you got into esports, how you got into the gaming world, the journey so far, and where you've ended up now.
Sure, man. Long journey. So started back in about 2008. Was playing Battlefield 2 back in the day. Still the best FPS in my opinion, and was just trying to get better. And one of my best mates at school, we were just obsessed with the game. We used to go to Hungry Jack's, or for those overseas, Burger King, every Wednesday after maths class, buy our $5 Super Stunner meals, and we'd flip over the paper that's on the tray and draw the map and talk about things that we did previously, like we were here and the enemies were here and these are the plays that we made.
Love it.
So then in those days everyone used to play in the same servers. Like, you know, there wasn't pugs in those days, especially with Battlefield. Like, it's not so much an esport title, which is why I got out of it eventually. But, you know, we used to always join these servers and you'd always have a clan tag you could put in front of your name. And there used to be a guy in there called Cardiology who used to just destroy everyone in this internode games on .NET server, Karkin 32 on 64. I remember asking him, like, what's a clan? How do I join that? And like, how are you destroying everyone? How do I become better? So that was kind of failing my way into that. And then my first foray into the business side of things, really, after I started playing with a more like newbie team first called Heat and then with Team Renegade, and you know, we became the best team in Australia for a while, near kind of just said the death of Battlefield 2 because I got into it late. I joined NetGame Radio, which is an online internet commentary network. So that was before any internet in Australia had enough upload to do video streaming. It was all radio streaming. So I did a trial there, started doing Battlefield 2 commentary. Some of which I still have, or at least I have some of my Counter-Strike Source commentary. I found it the other day. It's terrible. And then I just started taking more roles within there. I was in year 11 at the time, year 12 at the time. I think it was year 12. They had a minimum 17 age requirement for you to get in. So when I hit 17, I applied to work there. And then I just kept asking them to do more stuff. Their marketing manager left, so I was like, hey, can I do that? I did a Flash game review every fortnight with a friend of mine, became what I called the LAN affiliation manager. So I partnered with LAN parties and give them some of our sponsor prizes and they would help promote us. We'd help promote them. We'd commentate at their LANs if possible. And then one of the LANs I worked with up in Sydney, a guy there called JT said, hey, mate, I'm the graphics designer at a tech distributor. And Thermaltake's about to launch a new peripheral brand, Thermaltake being case coolers, power supplies, and modding equipment. And they want to inaugurate it with a massive $30,000 Call of Duty tournament that later ended up becoming CS Source. And this guy's run a bunch of LANs before, done networking, he's a coder, he's a graphics guy, but he's like, I've got no idea how to run a competitive esports tournament, please help. And I said, I've also got no idea, so let's do it. So I was an IT trainee at the time, and I was running this $30,000 tournament, of which the schools weren't very happy with because I was on MSN. You know, answering stuff and setting up servers like while I was at work in the server room trying to hide away. And yeah, kind of fell my way through that. Ended up getting a job from Thermaltake. So I moved from Tassie where I grew up to Melbourne, worked for them. And then to kind of speed through the rest of it, you know, I was at Thermaltake for 4 years as the esports and community manager. Left there, became a journalist for a year and a half, got headhunted by Corsair back into the space. While I was a journalist, I was actually studying social work, kind of got out of the industry for a bit. you know, managed some professional players. Like when I was at Thermaltake, managed one of Australia's first ever pros, Jared Krenzel, or Pig, who's a commentator these days in StarCraft 2 and a streamer. You know, managed teams, was a semi-pro CS player during my time at Thermaltake as well, and some, you know, top four team in Australia, made LAN finals at the CGPL season one, got destroyed by Voxy, who became Renegades, and all that kind of stuff. And then in 2018, had a quarter-life crisis, quit my job at Corsair, decided to become a consultant, thought I was going to convince every brand to get into esports and I'd be the vehicle to do it. Terrible idea. Kind of, I picked up some investment, failed my way around, hired some staff, scaled up that business, had 12 clients, 9 staff, a few million revenue, did a multi-million dollar deal, and then just got super burnt out running a service-based business, shut that down in 2022, paid back the investors, helped my staff find jobs, passed off all of our clients to my friends' agencies, like Chiefs, for example, who we've got in common. And then asked ourselves the question, like, how do we turn ourselves into AI? So kind of brings me to where I am today, you know, with bigger social / bigger AI, trying to figure out ways to fix the problems that ourself and our clients had running a service-based business. So how do we automate certain workflows by using AI? How do we map it out in a mind map and say from start to finish, how do we onboard a client, create a strategy for them, create their social media content, send it to them for approval, post it on their platform and do reports? You know, can we do all that by using AI? And then various other kind of bits in between, you know, some consultancy bits here and there, and trying to play games every now and then and go to the gym and play cricket. So yeah, a bit of a summary, man. But yeah, like you said in the intro, you know, if you're to go to a event, which is the widest employer of job roles in the industry, I've been there in every professional capacity except maybe like audio visual tech. I got not much of an idea about that, but you know, in 2022 I ran the world's largest VR esports event as the head of that with like 30 subcontractors. Have been the player on stage, have been the commentator, have been the player manager on stage as well. All that kind of stuff from start to finish, being the VIP, being the sponsor, being the journalist of that event, all that kind of stuff too. So have a kind of failed my way around every time I thought I found what I wanted to do, but what I really enjoy doing is working on the industry, not in it. And my superpower is being able to see where everything is and how things fit together and networking those people and that kind of stuff together. That's what's really exciting to me.
Yeah, I was going to say... That's awesome. I was going to say, like, having such an insight into so many domains within esports and the esports world, I think is so much value, right? Because I think nowadays, you know, you look at maybe pro players or coaches and they mainly have one avenue where they want to sort of stick in and be in forever, right? How realistic that is, right? But I think with yourself, did you ever, I guess when you first started playing, was it, I'm going to play for as long as I can and then see where it goes? Or what was the mindset about that?
Yeah, every time it was this is what I thought I was going to do. So I thought I was going to be, you know, a pro player playing on stage against NiP, because at the time, you know, they were the CS team. They have an 87-0 LAN record, right? So we, you know, we were a middling Counter-Strike team, like probably a top 32 in Australia. Then when CSGO came out, we went complete nerd mode and we became like a top 4, a top 6 team just off the graft of learning the game much better than anyone else. And you know, the thinking was, how far can we take that? We didn't have the individual skill. We're all complete nobodies. And in those days, people hated nobodies, where these days they're kind of embraced, right? But yeah, they hated kids and nobodies in those days. So if you were 14 and also the people didn't know who you were just relentlessly bullied online, to be clear about that, compared to like Donk today. Like, no one would pick up Donk back in the day, no matter how good he is. They would just all call him a cheater and say, well, I'm not playing with you. Who the fuck are you, kid? Don't talk to me. Which is stupid, right? It's the dumbest thing ever. So we went the opposite. So we're like, when the beta came out in October, we just spent hours and hours and hours just finding every boost spot, every skybox, taking screenshots of all the changes, because at that stage there were a lot of change logs with the scroll, you know, the buy wheel that was a circle. And it was a console port, essentially. It was a console game ported to PC. They made it console first. So in those days, it was cool not to watch demos. It was cool not to try. It was cool not to care. It's kind of like cricket is today, actually, in many ways. If you do, you don't tell people you do cricket coaching, like, you'll be banished, like, off to the... And, you know, like, we kind of took it the opposite. So, yeah, every time, like, I thought, this is what I wanted to do. So I did that. And then when I stopped and became a commentator, I did get, you know, one proper overseas opportunity, of which that guy is now an investor of mine, who was the head of esports at Face It. But, didn't mature, because even in these days too, right? He was like, we need you in London for a month. You have to leave in 2 weeks. And because of the passport laws, we can't pay you, but we could give you a laptop or three you could keep and take home. But even with that, like, and even though we're literally convicts of the UK back in the day. We can't go to the UK even to volunteer. Like, I couldn't even go there. So I had enough leave too and approval from my boss too. So that would have been good. That was the first NIP v Very Games event. It was at a hotel. It was like a 40K prize pool that they used with a, they sold a skin to do that. So long story short, yeah, every time I thought that's what I wanted to do. Then I went to Thermaltake. I thought I wanted to be a global marketing director of doing that. Then I was a journalist. I wanted to be like Anthony Gareffa at Tweaktown, who was my editor at the time. You know, he was going on press junkets. He was reviewing graphics cards. He was reviewing laptops. He was reviewing, like, he reviewed like a $15,000 OLED TV when they were brand new. Like, that's what I thought I wanted to do. Mm. And then I made an agency. I thought I wanted to be the biggest agency in the world and work with OMD Group and BMW and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But every time, like, I would get a certain amount of years or minutes or months or whatever into the job and then be like, I'm not learning enough anymore or this isn't scalable or something like that. Primarily when I was employed by others, it was I'm not learning enough. So when I was an IT trainee, I did it for 12 months. After 9 months, I was done. I think I was mentally checked out. And I still did the job. It's not like I didn't turn up to work, right? But after that, I was like, I've reached the cap. Then when I was at Thermaltake, you know, I was too young to understand, but my boss was pushing me at the same time because after 3 years in that job, I'm like, I've done it all. Mm. And I know he was like quietly, now I understand I'm older. He was always trying to push me in the direction of, you know, going upskill, get some more stuff, get another job, you know, kind of grow from there. But I just wasn't old enough or wise enough to understand that at the time that he was pushing me. And then same at Corsair as well. Different type of company, more budgets, that kind of stuff too. You know, maybe I didn't conquer journalism in a way like I feel I did the others, but I found I outgrow that stuff really quickly. And that's why I wanted to do an agency, because then I could work on multiple different types of projects. And I worked on so many different fucking things. I did PR for companies. I ran like local esports events. I ran the world's largest VR esports event. I did a $2 million beta launch for a VR game. I also did like $15,000 influencer projects in crypto, was external CMO and COO for crypto projects, helped to launch games, products, titles, like all this different kind of stuff. Work with influencers. I had an influencer. I never mentioned we had like a Phase House of Australia in 2018 for a while.
Oh, right.
2019 called Shade Crew. Had a mansion on the water, $2 down from Ricky Ponting and the Golden Mile. Like, did a lot. Different stuff. And it was just what I find is that when that all finished, there's no IP to sell, so that's the downside of it. But I have like a PhD now in running an agency for doing that for 4 years. So then it's like, okay, how do I take that into doing something else?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, a lot of experience. That's a breakdown, to be honest. Do you think that your experience over time has just sort of catapulted into each role that you've landed into? Say, for example, going from a pro player, going into a commentator, all those sort of things, it's sort of helped you catapult into where you are now?
Yeah, I think so. Like, you know, there's an advantage and a disadvantage, right? Like, there's an advantage of hyper specialization, and that's how you become truly successful, is you only have one job and you only work on one thing and you do it 24/7. And love him or hate him, it's the Elon Musk thing of sleeping at the office and working on one project. And I have an ex-client like that whose business has almost failed 3 or 4 times, but now it's going through strength and strength. And I know that's all he thinks about 24/7 is that one business.
Yeah,
That's all he ever thinks about and all he does. And I would say they're probably going to get a $150 million exit, and he probably owns 25% of that business in USD. So it'll be worth it in the end for him. And all the gray hairs, he has many more gray hairs than me. He's younger than me too. So it's like 5 or 6 years younger than me with a lot of gray hair now.
Wow.
So, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages. Whereas, you know, I have an old friend / mentor, I guess, of mine who is, he was like the first ever professional representation for athletes in Australia.
Mm.
And he also did a lot of music touring. And something he said to me once made a lot of sense of my background is he said when he started doing music touring in the US, they were shocked at the breadth of knowledge that he had. Because over there, you can spend your entire career only doing venue catering for stadium events, one thing. And you can do that for 40, 60 years. In Australia, you can't afford to. Like when I was running those Counter-Strike events, like 16-team Counter-Strike events at Mid-City Internet Cafe in Melbourne, with the most disgusting toilets you've ever seen in your entire life. I was playing in those and running it at the same time. I created the servers on my laptop. Mm. I booked the venue. I took the entry fees. I found volunteers to help do that stuff. You know, I sourced the commentators. I wrote the scripts. I got other sponsors to put in like graphics cards. And, you know, we had like M-Wave $25 vouchers. I gave them away. I took the photos at the event and uploaded them and did the post-event reports. Like I did everything there from start to finish. So I now have that hands-on knowledge of how to create a CS server and how to set up the PCs to make sure that the event's going to be successful. shuffle and how to do seeding and how to fit 16 teams into a day by having 8 in the morning, 8 in the afternoon. Like, I found all that out. And what that helped to teach me too is just the methodology of doing that same stuff. I'm a very start to finish type guy. Like when I was at uni and did essays, I have to do the introduction, the body, the conclusion. Mm-hmm. And I just did the same with an event. I sat down and I thought, okay, how, I've never run a live esports event like that before. How do I run from start to finish? What do I need? Well, people got to pay entry fees. Okay, figure that out. And then I need a venue for people to play at. Okay, got to figure that out. And I need some more prizes. Okay, got to figure that out. I just went from start to finish through that. And yeah, it worked out in the end.
Yeah, I like that. And I think it's a pretty good, I think especially for some listeners tuning in, like understanding that sort of work pattern and almost having what I like to deem a mental template to some, to organization, having like a bit of a structure that you almost just go back to and rebound back to, and something that you can sort of always just understand, hey, this works for me. This might work for someone else. Let's try it. Let's test it. It doesn't really work for me. Let's cater it towards what I like to do and then sort of bounce on that. So yeah, I really
think
that's good.
And I find a lot of similarities between esports and the business and the thing that you mentioned in cricket as well, which is part of why I like it so much. A, cricket is so stats heavy, just like esports is,
yeah,
you know, with
absolutely.
HLTV stats, and you've got everything from kill assist ratio to aim percentage to headshot percentage to, there's just so many stats, and it's the same in cricket. Yeah. You can go through hundreds of stats for each position, for each player, for your batter, bowler, fielder, whatever, but it's also mental processes. And this was something that I was never great at as a player. It's like, you can't play harder. It's impossible. And the same in cricket. So if you're a bowler and you try to play harder, usually you try to run in faster and then your timing is wrong and you bowl a no ball and your action is wrong. The flow of everything you do is wrong and you bowl the wrong ball and the wrong delivery as well. If you try to hit the ball harder, your head goes up in the sky, you get clean bowled. You can't, you know, the only thing you can do in cricket is run harder, really. That's about it. You can run harder after the ball, but, you know, you can't bowl harder. You can't bat harder. All you can do is concentrate harder. And it's the same, you know, in gaming and esports as well. It's mental processes. That's what it is. You know, you need to make sure, and I've seen this firsthand in the low-level cricket that I play, where I played a fantastic match and then the next two or three I got out by losing my concentration. And there's a common thing in business that I talk to my co-founder about a lot, that's from cricket as well. In cricket, you want to win every ball. Every ball is an event. So every time you're batting, you need to have all of your processes down pat. You could tap the bat the same amount of times, do your pre-warm-up, do your trigger movement, make sure everything's in alignment. So for me, it's my front shoulder towards mid-on. It's making sure my feet are in the right position. It's making sure in my mind as the bowler's running in, I'm saying front foot, front foot, front foot, front foot.
Yep.
Because as soon as you stop, and I had this happen firsthand, this 14-year-old whiz kid, as he was walking in, as he was running into bowl, I was saying front foot, front foot, front foot. And then I got distracted for a split second. I went on the back foot, I got clean bowled.
Yeah,
and that was the week after I made 50 and gave zero chances and completely dominated the other team. And I was like, fuck, man. Like, it's all processes.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of the reason why I like it so much. But it's the same, you know, with kind of business. And there's a mental coach I've had that I've worked with for a bit that covers, you know, that exact same kind of stuff too. And, you know, win every ball. And it can be the same in business. It's like win every meeting or win every day. And a win doesn't have to mean, same in cricket, a win doesn't have to mean you hit a six. But a win could mean you don't get out. Like, and it's the same in a meeting. Like, a win doesn't mean that you have to secure the client, get the bag. You know, a win could mean that you've just built a better relationship with that person.
Absolutely.
And they're going to come back around and now they can trust you. Or a win could mean that you go into it where the client's really pissed off at you and they come out a little bit less pissed off at you.
Yeah.
Like, that could be a win. So, yeah.
Love it. Love that frame of mind. I think it's, yeah, important to sort of change things to sort of understand what works for you. In terms of stats, and obviously you mentioned it sort of intertwined throughout, I think when people look to social media and look towards stats, they look to likes, look to shares, look to all that sort of, you know, obviously everything you know regarding social media in terms of trying to be an influencer, trying to grow your own brand. Some people get really whittled down the stats and obviously sometimes lose a bit of confidence if they put a ton of effort into a post, all of a sudden it gets 5 likes. What do you think is the mindset that people should have towards content creation in terms of developing and trying to grow yourself in that space?
Content that you want to see. Like I had a podcast as well. And then after a while, I was so bored of my own podcast and I was like, well, fuck, everyone else is going to be bored of this.
Yeah.
But it worked really well for me. And it's probably another good point too, because that podcast never got a lot of views, but it got the right views. Like I was just texting Clinton Sparks before this from Global Gaming League, and we became friends because he came to my podcast. I don't think I would have ever met him without LinkedIn, without that podcast. He's a Grammy nominated artist. He worked with Lady Gaga on Born This Way album. He did an Eminem mixtape. He's responsible for the song Turn Down For What. He discovered DJ Snake and partnered him with Lil Jon, which I give him shit for all the time because I'm so sick of that song. But, you know, like it's reaching the right people, and it's been the same with my LinkedIn for a long time. You know, I've created lots of content on there. I've gotten like $5 million of inbound sales and investment through LinkedIn, and I've never got anywhere near like who's like a tier two influencer, Pokimane numbers or Nick Merck's numbers, let alone Ninja's numbers, let alone MrBeast numbers. Mm-hmm. But I'm reaching the right people, and LinkedIn will tell me the job titles and roles of people that are viewing your content, yeah. And they are specifically the people I want to reach. They're decision makers. They're people working at businesses that I want to reach, like Twitch and Amazon and YouTube and that kind of stuff too. So, you know, when in what I would call maybe the heyday of LinkedIn, like when my account was the lightest and I was making the most content, if I was getting 100 likes on a post, that was very good for me. But also I knew that that was 100 people that I wanted to reach. Out of that, 88 people of those are people specifically that I want to reach with that content. So just making sure that, and then whenever I had the most success is making content that's interesting to me. And that's how I started on LinkedIn. I just started saying like, well, if there's an article that's interesting to me and I liked it, it gave me something, I should share it because someone else will probably like it too.
Mm.
And then it just kind of grew from there.
I love that. That's 100% the main reason I started MindClickers was to understand other people's perception, but also to gain knowledge myself and understand like what's going on within the esports world, especially from a pro player perspective, right? Because at the time I was just getting into esports. I hadn't really worked with many pro players. So having pro players on to talk about their mindset, how they prepare for a game, how they feel on stage, that gave me knowledge as well to sort of understand, hey, I can use that, right? So I think in regards to creating content, I think one of the biggest things is that you have to enjoy. You have to, yeah, as you mentioned, something that you want to watch, something that you want to listen to, something that you want to read is one of the biggest things. What do you think in regards to comments? Because I know that comments, I've seen it on like Instagram, for example, people creating comments, people creating content, but then getting negative content and trying to shut that down whilst actively staying on path. It's a tricky balance.
And there's kind of two parts to it. So, you know, the old Joe Rogan thing is post and ghost, but you can only really do that when you're of that size. Like you need to engage with people. So I learned something from a guy I look up to called Matthew Wu. Yep. The first ever event around at Thermaltake, I ran with him. He was at ASUS and he was like a semi-pro level COD player. And, you know, I remember on Facebook, like when Facebook was king, whenever he would make something on his own profile, he would like every single person who ever replied to his stuff. And if you go through all my LinkedIn posts, you'll notice I like every single comment, unless it's something that I simply can't agree with, or it's egregious, or the guy's a fuckwit, basically. So it'll be pretty obvious when I don't like something, I think, yeah. You know, it'll be someone saying some stupid, like sexist thing or whatever, you know, yeah. some stupid opinion. And then I will try to engage with a lot of those as well. And I've become very good at asking leading questions, but man, it's so hard. Like, you know, they say about, you know, about society changing or whatever, but man, one look at Instagram and TikTok is incredible. Like someone, you know, doing what's a bench press one rep max to them, and there's just like 5,000 people in the comments calling them piss weak. Like it's fucking crazy. It's like, yeah. You don't know the background of this person or what they've done, or maybe they're amazing at deadlifts and terrible at bench, or they had a pec injury. Like who cares even?
Yeah.
You know, like, but just, yeah, it's just insane. And it hasn't come to LinkedIn as much. You get some Facebook boomer type stuff on LinkedIn every now and then. But yeah, there was, for a long time, it was just for me, it's like asking leading questions and trying to get answers and never giving opinions unless specifically asked or paid, you know, to give those opinions. And that's what I'll generally do. But I would often lead people in the direction of giving an opinion.
Mm.
So, you know, asking leading questions. And the same with like, and it happens a lot. Like if someone, say on LinkedIn, will leave a comment that I won't necessarily agree with, or especially if it's short, I'll ask them to expand. And usually they don't. Like it's exceptionally rare that they will give more. They will just state something like it's fact and that's it. They won't give any more information. So I'm a big fan of stats and data and seeing how, you know, making apples to oranges comparisons and finding ways to make them apples to apples. You know, that's something that I really enjoy as well. And something I've been working on forever that I can't find the answer to. So if someone listening to this is good at maths, I want to find how to give an apples to apples comparison between MrBeast and an entire media network. Like I want to be able to say like MrBeast is X percent larger or smaller than Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
How do I do that? I think I could figure it out if I sit down for a week, but I don't want to do that. So. Yeah.
Well, the details will be in the episode. So if anyone wants to reach out, I'm sure we can sort something out. Legendary. Now we talked about it very briefly at the start, but I've always been encapsulated, obviously, as an OCE coach. Like we go international and sometimes the results really don't show. The effort we put in as an OCE sort of region, going into NA, going into EU, going to Meta, going to SAM, there's levels towards esports. Where are we, do you think, in regards to OCE versus the world? And what's your perspective, I guess, as a whole? How do we fit in? Are we ever going to continue to grow? Are we at our stagnating time now? Are we just going to regress? Where do you think we are, I guess, as a whole?
Feels like, in a way, you know, I mean, in my history as well, I also founded an esports association, you know, which was a member-based association, not a governing body, very specifically developed like that. And, you know, for the government to be able to fund esports and gaming, you need a representation body, and that's never going to happen in the space for a multitude of reasons that takes 17 podcasts to do. But, you know, it feels like just the pathways are severely lacking. And once again, if you look at cricket, like cricket's in a similar situation. You've got test playing nations / full members like Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and Australia and England and South Africa, et cetera. And then you have associate nations who may play or be eligible to play in some kind of World Cups. And you see the difference in funding and support between those pathways is gigantic. Mm-hmm. And usually the results of that. And funnily enough, to become an associate member into a full test playing nation and a full member, you need to win a certain amount of tournaments. But it's like, it's the old startup conundrum. You need money to make money, right? Like, you've got to spend money to make money, but you don't have that money to spend.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same here. Like, we don't have any developed pathways for people to come up and to develop within different games. We don't have a strong high school esports network. I don't think we could ever have a strong, like, university or collegiate network, because they're just not, universities here are not at all like they are in the US. They're not, you know, in the US, they're like high schools, or in Australia, they're just places you kind of go to. I have zero allegiance to the university I went to, and so does my mom, and so does my wife, and you couldn't care less. You know, they don't have clubs, and they don't have, you know, these big kind of events, kind of thing. So, you know, having those strong pathways, and that's why I started creating those Counter-Strike events. So I knew that I wanted, and my team wanted to go pro and wanted to be better. But we needed live event experience, because we had approximately zero, you know, live as a team. So I was like, well, fuck it. I better go run the events then. And my first ever CS event had three teams, including ours. And we won, funnily enough, pretty easily too. And then that grew to a 16-team event that I would run. And, you know, I think it was like three teams, then it was eight, then it was 16. And I ran six of them, and I probably played at three or four of them and commentated the others. Six or seven. They were called TT Hublands back in the day. So, you know, even just things like that don't exist anymore to provide those pathways. So you look at, like, the massive fall off, and you see this, you know, once again, to use a cricket analogy, you see that where they might be able to scratch together an 11 to play cricket, but there's zero depth. And if their one good fast bowler gets an injury, that's it. They're fucked. Whereas in Australia, in England, in India, you know, in South Africa, if you get one or two people injured, you've got four or five, you know, quality people who can then replace them in multiple departments, where they're fielders, where they're batters, wicketkeepers, bowlers. And it's the same in esports, right? Like, if you're in the US and you have an AWPer that you can't have, there's plenty of other AWPers to pick from. But if you're, like, Renegades for a long time in Australia, or FlyQuest as per now, like, your talent pool is so shallow that when one of your guys is out of form, you can't bench him and rotate him. Who are you going to get? You know, there's going to be a 25% drop off in skill, and then you're screwed, because he hasn't been able to go to any international tournaments because you've gone to them all. And the US used to be like that, Evil Geniuses, and Australia used to be like that with Team Immunity before it changed a little bit for a while, where they were the only team in the entire region with money, and they would get all the best players and take them overseas, and everyone else was locked out. And Team Immunity would have a rotating probably 11 people, and that was it. And you could never beat them, and you could never get any better. So they would stomp everyone in Australia, then they go to World Cyber Games and get absolutely stomped. And they come back, stomp Australia, and then it would just go over and over and over again, you know, in CS 1.6. And, you know, some of those people went on to higher things, like Sponge, for example. But, you know, it was like Sponge, Imagine, Sniper, Havoc, all those kind of guys, you know. They would do it over and over and over again.
Crazy. Yeah, it definitely is such an interesting facet. Because I remember back when I joined Renegades back in, what, 2021? This was the Rocket League side of things. It was a region where I think there's realistically three top teams in Rocket League. So it is a competing time for LAN, but the following season, it's like, well, now there's clearly two best teams. And it definitely does come down to resources. Like, I think last year in Rocket League, there was like two teams that are actually on a paid salary. So I think it's hard to actually get to a point where there is that level of resources within OCE in comparative to NA, where there's 16, 32 teams who are all on paid salaries. EU, you know, how many teams are on paid salaries, right? And it's tricky.
It's also who you can compete against, right? Like when we were trying to go pro in Counter-Strike, you know, I would argue the top three teams in Australia were like Team Immunity, Vox Eminor, and ourselves.
Mm.
Voxy hated us because we were nobodies. They used to love to troll us. Team Immunity, kind of a love-hate relationship. And then everyone else was too easy. So we could never play. We basically never played against Voxy because if you want to play against people who are better than you to become better, you know, we basically never played against them. We rarely ever played against Immunity. And then everyone else, we would just smash. So I'm not learning much winning 16-10 all the time against the finest from New Zealand or Atletico or any of those other teams. So, you know, that the practice talent pool is so weak. And you see that with Counter-Strike teams too. They report, they go overseas and just no one will play them. They're like, well, we can't warm up for the major because for some reason everyone hates us.
Yeah.
And no one will play against.
So, oh, yeah. Give me flashbacks. I guess on that side, I remember having an episode with Dave Harris, and I think we talked about the issue of, or not really the issue, but the reality of imports. And I think imports does play a pretty big role, especially within OC, right? Because just this last season, we imported a German player. We did pretty well, made Birmingham, had a pretty good time. So what do you think the prospect of importing players into OC is like from that perspective?
Yeah, I think it's great. Like you're going to learn a lot.
Mm.
Bring someone else in. I mean, Renegades in Counter-Strike had that for a while too, didn't they? They had a coach from overseas, like a player. I was talking to Dexter about it just recently. I can't remember what his name was off the top of my head though, but someone from Europe, right?
Mm.
Yeah, I think he can bring a lot. I mean, another way to look at that, once again, to use a cricket analogy, is look at the Big Bash League in Australia, you know, our local domestic tournament. They've got primarily Australian players and they'll import two, maybe three people from overseas in specialist key positions. Like they're going to learn so much. Like who was it? I think it was the Melbourne Stars are bringing in like Shaheen Afridi from Pakistan, one of the, you know, all time fast bowlers.
Yeah.
Like the other bowlers there are going to learn so much from him, and he's probably going to learn a lot from them about how to bowl in Australian conditions specifically. Mm. So yeah, I think that's amazing. You know, spending some good money and bringing in import and a star that you can do. And it happens with county cricket over in England as well. You know, they'll send over one. You know, there'll be one West Indian or one Australian or whoever that plays with them in their starting 11 when they're playing in county cricket there too. And they always talk about there's so much learning both ways. The Aussie learns how to play over there much better, and they'll also learn, you know, what those specific skills from this person are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely an interesting trivia. I'm sort of reflecting back to a couple of years ago when I joined Elevate, and me and Kami and Virtuoso went to Japan. And we picked up Realize, and we sort of went to APAC and sort of elevated the region as a whole. At start, there was obviously a lot of clapback, like, oh, you're going to take over the region. But at the time, we went there and we started scrimming teams that wouldn't get access to the level of scrims that they normally would have, right? So I think there's that level of giving experience to those who might not ever have that experience. I can definitely see Devil's Advocate being the same way, whereby you're taking opportunities away from the region. But I think leveling up the region as a whole to make it more competitive should definitely be a pretty big priority as a whole.
Yeah, maybe another way to look at it too is the MMA mold. Mm-hmm. You know, MMA was made a lot better, and I'll probably get it wrong. Is it there's one in Miami? Maybe it's Team Alpha Male, maybe it's someone else. But basically, a rich person built an entire facility and would give people like free accommodation and to be their manager for them to come in.
Right.
And he advanced MMA so much because it was so, you know, MMA is a solo person sport. They don't get paid anywhere near as much as most people think to compete, especially at the under UFC level, but even at the UFC level, they're basically not livable wage for them to be able to fight there. So, you know, this one team single-handedly brought up the level so much by taking the initial loss of creating that facility, but then managing those guys as they became, you know, much larger. And would help to train them up. And same thing, people then from Brazil would fly over there and other countries too. Because for a long time, like Brazil would dominate it. And then, you know, the next example is probably Khabib and his team over in Dagestan, like the smallest, most random, weird place ever that's just got so many UFC champions at it and so many high-level competitors. But they do the same thing. They run these massive camps and they all train together. And then people go over and they live there for 6 months, whatever, or maybe permanently. To be able to train with those guys and their skill set too. So there's no reason why we couldn't do the same here in Australia and make it a destination to bring someone or some people over, you know, to join and help us become better. Because I could just imagine, like, you know, early CS, if Voxy imported, you know, Scream's probably a bad example from France because he barely speaks English from my understanding. But, you know, bringing over someone like that, like an international proper quality level player, even a tier two player, is going to do so much more, you know, for the entire scene. And then with one, maybe bring some more. And then have a massive advantage over here.
Yeah, I think it's just such a massive trajectory that OC can have as a whole. On the flip side, we talk about sponsors. Where's your mindset in regards to OC and sponsors? Obviously, we talked about yourself sponsoring your own events, doing that stuff from a startup perspective. What is it like in terms of esports from a sponsorship perspective? Obviously, EUNA, Giant, big sponsors. Are they looking at OC, do you think?
No, short answer, no. Long answer, they're not globally. It's really struggle street for all esports teams globally right now. Have a lot of inside knowledge from a lot of friends who are chief revenue officers or head of biz dev at various teams from around the world. And you know, some of my investors who are helping other teams raise capital or invested before too. It's really tough. And the reality is that the return just isn't there. You know, Australia kind of speed run any percent sponsorship. Like a long time ago, compared to other places overseas. We did it with investment and we did it with sponsorship here because Australia is much more risk adverse and it's a smaller market. And we overperform for our market. Like, so whenever I was working at these peripheral brands, you know, we've got say 10% of the population of the US, but we would outsell them, you know, per capita each time. So, yeah. We've got more disposable income and all that kind of stuff too, right? But also we're very risk adverse. You look at our country, we like to pull things out of the ground. You know, that's it's very safe. We like real estate because it's physical, it's houses, it's land. That's what we enjoy here. And it's the same with sponsorship. But, you know, the return just hasn't been there. And it's the same scale as the US. So esports teams here in Australia have 10x less selling potential and they're making the same kind of losses on deals and as the team goes compared to the US. So where the US, you know, doing the maths. So where we may get a $1 sponsorship from there, they may get a $10 sponsorship over there, but still we're spending $4 to get that $1 sponsorship and they're spending $40 to get that $10 sponsorship. So in the end, there's just no return. And then also that $1 sponsorship isn't worth it for the brand. It's probably worth more than 30 cents. So they're triple overpaying and also the team's still losing 4X. And that's, you know, that's across the board. Like when I went to India last year, talking to, I don't want to dox who they are, but talking to someone over there from a brand, you know, they said we lost 70 cents on the dollar in our esports sponsorships. So instead of getting a return on investment, you know, they lost quite a lot. So that means that a lot of these teams are held up by gambling money because gambling can't do meta ads. You know, this crypto casino, they can't do meta ads. They can't do Google ads. Where they're going to spend their money? It has to be influencers in esports. They don't have anywhere else to spend. So, you know, they will sponsor a major team for 1.2 to 3 mil, so let's say 800K to 3 mil, which is fairly, 3 mil is exceptionally rare, but more like the 800K to 1.2 mil for most of these big teams. And then everybody else is like 50 grand or something. And then because esports has been over-professionalized and grown far too much compared to what it should, then these players are saying, well, I want 100 grand salary. And they've got 2,000 Twitter followers and they don't create any YouTube content or TikToks or anything like that. Yeah. And they're in a league that gets 15,000 concurrent viewers and the numbers just simply don't add up.
Yeah.
And it's the same in Australia. Once again, like say the OPL, Oceanic Pro League here in Australia, you've got players with 200 Twitter followers being paid 45 grand to play in a league with 5,000 peak concurrent viewers. And the LCS, you've got players being paid 150 to 300K to compete in a league with 60K concurrent viewers. Mm. It's just the same stuff. So in Australia, you could maybe get a sponsorship for 3K a quarter USD. And in the US, you could get 30K a quarter USD, but you're spending 10X more on those players in the US and you're making 10X the losses. But once again, it's just the same and you're getting 10X the views, but it's just the same, give or take a little bit. So yeah, it's rough. There's something that I've been tipped off to. I've been doing a lot of research on around esports teams and events following the influencer mold is going towards more media buys instead of sponsorship. So media is just so much larger. And when we're talking about media buys, that's like Group M spending $100 million a year for Allianz on Google ads, Facebook ads, TikTok ads, you know, physical billboards out of home, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
That's so much larger than any team will spend on sponsorship. So if you can prove a CPM-based model of just having views, then maybe that's a way to go. And that's how a lot of these influencer things like Baller League and, you know, there's a French like Formula 3 league that they do events out of stuff too. That's how they're doing it. They're backing themselves and saying, look, we're influencers. We've got a lot of other here. We know we're going to get 20 million views. So we're just going to sell it on CPM. So instead of saying to a brand, trust us, give us 2 mil up front, they're like, hey, brand, give us $0 up front and then give us whatever their CPM rate is, $1.30 per 1,000 views.
Yeah.
And the end, instead of getting 2 mil, they're getting 10. And it's much easier for them to acquire that. And the brand's happy because they're like, well, I know what my return on investment is going to be, that or my return on ad spend, my ROIS. is likely to be. So, and the CPM, you could just undercut the meta CPM a little bit as well. And then off you go, happy days. And instead of giving Zuck 2 mil, they're giving you 1.8. And you're like, fine, gravy, let's go. Because then a sponsorship would have given you 600.
Yeah.
And you don't have to worry about non-competes, and you don't have to worry about activating much for them and all this kind of stuff too. So there's other minor advantages too. So some teams are looking into that. But yeah, long story short, it's rough. But for a reason, and this is content I've made before too around that, like, you know, VC dollars have over-professionalized esports a lot. If you look from 10 years ago when I was doing $25 entry, you know, 16-team local LAN events, you know, it just hasn't, you know, scaled now to $1 million majors. Yes, there's a lot more views, but if you think, like, and I've made some content about this too, it costs 3 mil to run a major.
Wow.
So, you know, do you think there, even if the arena is sold out, you can do the maths, 7,000 tickets at $25 a ticket. Well, that doesn't make anywhere near that. They're flying 40 staff in from Germany to do audio visual, and they're giving them hotels. How much does that cost? They're flying in 16 teams plus a manager plus a coach, you know, in premium economy, and putting them up in a 4.5-star hotel and doing all their transfers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's before they spent 200K on LED screens and camera equipment and security guards and everything else.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, are they getting that back? You know, is Intel Extreme Masters IEM Melbourne, are they getting, you know, $1.5 million from Intel just for one event? Nah, surely not. Yeah. It doesn't add up. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's rough. It's definitely an interesting world that we're sort of dividing into, and it's definitely going to be interesting over the next 5 years what the landscape starts to, you know, emerge from.
Yeah, I think it'll just be a bit of a rescindence, and there already has been in certain things, like talking to Jeremy from Prodigy, you know, he manages a lot of Rocket League players.
Yeah.
You know, there's already been a reset in Rocket League salaries a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we're well overdue. I believe, and I can't validate this for sure, but I believe there's been some sort of reset in League of Legends player salaries.
Mm.
And I believe that Counter-Strike really needs a reset in salaries. And from talking to some of my friends of mine, like Dexter, you know, he recently got benched from FlyQuest. Like,
yeah.
You know, just explain to him for 30 seconds that as a player, he can understand that and go, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Yeah. You know, they probably should be. Like, you know, once again, it's just the mass of what I said before. You know, a player with 10,000 Twitter followers, unfortunately, just should not be getting paid 100 to 300 grand a year to play in these events. There's just no return on that spend. And I understand they work hard and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, bricklayers work hard. Doesn't mean that they're paid 500 grand a year, you know, to be bricklayers. So, yeah, it's just what that return, you know, what that return is going to be and where it's going to come from. But, yeah, I think there'll just be a bit of a reset. And one of the other things I say is, like, look at an ESL stream, look at a UFC stream. The ESL stream is better.
Mm.
The commentators in the UFC are sitting on a trestle table with a black tablecloth at a ringside. look at the setups that they have at an ESL event, which is awesome. It looks great. But what's the sponsorship of UFC versus a sponsorship? You know, they're doing like
crazy.
Conor McGregor fight. They're doing $3.5 million gate. People are paying $3.5 million just for tickets to get in there.
Yeah.
They're not paying that for an IEM Melbourne. They're not paying that for an IEM Cologne or for an ESL One event or a Blast Austin Major. You know, people aren't buying corporate booths for like $400,000 for those events like they are for the UFC with a meet and greet, you know, with Francis Ngannou or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So it's just not, it just needs to rescind back to a level that's sustainable, which is much lower than it is. And the viewership will stay the same or be slightly less, and the players will be paid less and all that kind of stuff, but everything else will be the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to play, I was just thinking about it when you were saying, but I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here. Obviously, the last 3 years, we've seen a pretty big emergence from the Saudi perspective. So I've been to both Gamers 8s and last year's World Cup, and they're pretty blown out. Like, the facilities, everything's sort of, everyone, when that time comes around, everyone's obviously looking at that from the esports perspective and thinking, is this the normative? Is this what every other esports event is like? Do you think Saudi's having a positive impact, or it's like, oh, you know, the expectations are pretty high, this isn't replicatable across other events as well? Do you think they're having, what sort of impact?
Definitely not replicable. Well, I can't even say that word. It's definitely not going to be replicated unless someone else comes in with a ton of money to flash around. But look at the layoffs at ESL for a clear indication as to where it's going to go into the future. You know, it's obvious that they're spending money for certain reasons. It's to raise their profiles for tourism. It's for that kind of stuff. But people will continue to lose money until they don't want to anymore. And that's what influencer esports teams have done. You know, there's been influencer esports teams in the past, you know, like Disguised Toast team or, you know, those other kind of teams as well. I could see like Moist Critical's team, like Team Moist and things like that are happy to lose money until they're not. anymore. You know, Meta is happy at the moment to lose money doing virtual reality development until they're not. One day they'll stop. And they'll say, okay, we're sick of this. That's it. We're done. And that's when the rescindence will happen. And it, you know, in an early stage, it happened that a lot. In Australia, there was players who were like, well, you know, happened in the OPL. They're like, well, we know other teams are getting 45 grand a year salaries or 35 grand a year salaries and free housing accommodation. So I want that too. Mm. And it's like, well, bro, you've got 150 Twitter followers. Like legitimately, there were teams that had players which had sub 200 Twitter followers who were asking for 45 grand a year playing in a league that has 5,000 current viewers. Like, sorry, it's just not sustainable. And guess what happened? Every single one of those tier one teams in Australia has either completely died or been sold as a distressed asset. Every single one. Avant sold for the price of a single sponsorship. You know, like things like that too. So, you know, while some of these teams did raise, like can't say who, but, you know, one of those top teams in the OPL raised 500K to $1 million valuation and then sold for about 130 grand a few years later.
Mm.
So in the end, they're worth nothing. Order. Order went through liquidation. Not a single person bought Order.
Yeah.
They raised what, like 6 mil in total, spent it all on creating a brand and then couldn't sell that brand for $1. In the end.
Crazy.
So, you know, there just needs to be, you know, if they raise less money and spent less and tried to do not as many things, you know, they tried to be an esports org, they tried to be an influencer org, they tried to be a tournament operator and a merch supplier and an event operator. Just pick your lane. And then instead of doing all that and spending a mil on each by raising six, just raise 1 mil and do one thing properly, or raise 1.5 mil and do one thing properly. And they may still be around today.
Yeah.
If that's the case. But yeah, man. So yeah, there'll be a rescindence, but it happens with everything. Like that Saudi money is about to come into cricket too. Mm-hmm. Very interesting to see what happens in that space. There's a lot of likenesses between esports and cricket, and there's a lot of likenesses between esports and MMA. And a lot of the bad likenesses are with cricket, or say like the mental stuff we talked about before. And a lot of the things we should be doing is like MMA. We should be so much more like the UFC and we're not. Mm-hmm. Should be much more focused on individuals with storytelling, with singular events, not necessarily pay-per-views because it's not going to work, but there are so many things we should learn with the rise of the UFC over a similar period to esports. Like UFC basically come into prominence when, you know, Koreans were going nuts over StarCraft 1 and Warcraft 3 and CS 1.6. So we should be to the same level as the UFC. We really should be, but we're not. And there are some other limitations because of publishers and all that kind of stuff, right?
Mm.
But yeah, we should learn so much more from MMA and the UFC than we are right now.
Interesting. I've never really sort of drawn that comparison. I'm definitely be on the lookout for more sort of comparisons now. I know Hunter used to watch, Hunter loves watching UFC. So yeah.
Storytelling.
I suppose. Yeah.
Storytelling's the major one. Yeah. And that's what I was talking to Clinton Sparks this morning about Global Gaming League. You know, he's trying something like that with GGL. They did their pilot over the weekend. You know, they raised a bunch of money, have a bunch of interesting people behind it. T-Pain's his business partner in that too, who's an authentic gamer, streams on Twitch a lot. But, you know, he just, I sent him a screenshot of me watching it. You know, he asked me what I thought and I said, I'm really interested to see your storytelling because that's what matters. And that's he's good at that too, historically. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Just thinking about it as well, one I guess OCE org that stands out to me at the moment is Power, obviously from Lachlan, coming from a very, I guess, direct influencer based, and now they're dabbling in esports with Rocket League, but their priority isn't esports, right? Their priority is creating content, their priority is marketing, they've got brands, they've got clothing. I think that's probably the way to do it with an OCA.
100%, it's the way to do it internationally. You know, it's the way FaZe did it with massive success.
Yep.
And they fell over just due to severe mismanagement. Really, it's nothing to do with their brand or anything else like that. And that's coming from me. I've got a lot of friends who were at FaZe and a lot of friends who are leading FaZe now, you know, through their rebirth, like Jeff Pabst, the chief revenue officer, who I met because I did a podcast, funnily enough.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 100%, man. Because if you look at their first ever video, got over 1 million views. And their first, like, 10 videos didn't get under 600K views from memory from years ago. Like, what esports team has ever released a video to get 600K views? Go and look at all of Team Liquid and OG and Cloud9 and everyone else.
Fnatic.
And just go look there. Yeah, Fnatic, who were, you know, TSM laundry list, right? Maybe TSM could get one because they've got a bit more personality. But, you know, what's their USP from a business point? Like, what's their unique selling proposition or unique selling potential or unique whatever you want to call it, right? They're all just like, our branding is, we are a professional team that wins games. There's only really allowed to be one of those, and it probably is Team Liquid because they've run the most tournaments ever and they've got the highest prize pool ever. So it's probably them that could take that crown.
Mm-hmm.
So then what do you need to do after that?
Mm.
Like, you need to create something special. Like, you need what OG used to be, which is only Dota 2 and all about the family and community and these, like, really kind of reclusive nerdy guys that are fucking amazing at Dota. Like, you know, that's good. you know, to have that. And you've got, you know, G2 with like their intricacies and their interesting thing. You've got FaZe, which has started from the bottom. Now we're here, we have a gang sign kind of thing. Mm. Like, you know, we're young money, we're rich, we don't give a fuck, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, you need some sort of branding like that. And from having friends in the industry and who work at these teams, like, I'm sorry, but tell me the difference between Cloud9, Fnatic, TSM, Team Liquid, et cetera, et cetera, FlyQuest. I just don't see a big difference between those teams at all. They just seem like the same kind of thing in my mind. Rogue is another one. Yeah, mm-hmm. just add to the list.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is interesting. It's hard to differentiate yourself, and I think that's probably the gauging factor that a lot of teams need to take into consideration if they want to have, you know, a bit of an outside-the-box moment. Yeah.
Yeah, you need an identity. And I know that there were screaming matches at FaZe from the board level of whenever they would publish a video. The executives would want to do this sponsored video, and I know that FaZe Banks, etc., would be there saying, that is cringe. We are not releasing that video. It will fuck our brand. Mm. We're not doing it. You know, I can't even think of an example to my head, so I'm not the content creator, right? But yeah. I know that that was the case, and screaming matches in the boardroom were probably not the way to go, but it worked, didn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you look at the case studies of FaZe 2019, and I released some stuff on it recently, you know, FaZe 2019, 16 city blocks. That's how long the line was to see it in New York City. And then the next day, FaZe Rug himself just did a meetup. 3,500 people turned up in 100-degree Fahrenheit heat to go see him. Oath got shut down by the cops because there were too many people there. You know, they did $2 million worth of champion merch in one day, and champion cut them off. They said, you got to stop. This is too much. They did $1 million in the first hour.
Yeah.
Like, they sold another drop with heat, these kind of like heat do these boxes where you buy like a loot box essentially that comes with like last season's high-end fashion. They sent me one, so it had like off-white shorts, some designer socks in it, plus like a FaZe crew neck and a FaZe t-shirt. That's what was in like this lovely like Gucci style packaging. They sold out of every size under like 4XL in like 20 minutes. So, you know, that it works. Like, when it works, you just need to, you know, create that branding and that style and create that aspiration of FaZe.
Mm.
And then just not die due to terrible management.
a balancing act that's definitely hard to master. You've got to mix a few potions.
Yeah. Fly so close to the sun, it happens sometimes. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, we've got to get into it. Before we turn off the gas and roll down the hill towards the end of the episode, you are the AI guy. So I want to know more about your perspective in terms of AI, esports, the world of AI. Where are we at the moment? I think AI has been pretty crazy at the moment. It's definitely seen a bit more of an expansion over the last year. A lot more people started to use AI online. I've even seen people start to make their own branding in terms of esports orgs from purely built from AI from the ground up. You know, where are we with AI at the moment, and what do you see, I guess, the next 5 years looking like as well?
Yeah, I'd say it's incredible. There's many great proof of concepts, but the main difference between the last, you could say, like, bubble of crypto and current with AI is we did a lot of work in crypto too, and I do think it has some use cases for sure, especially smart contracts. If someone wants to look that stuff up, that's fantastic. Which are essentially, could work in esports too, which is essentially contracts that are on the blockchain that when certain actions happen, other actions will happen. So, for example, people are notoriously not paid out prize pools, right, in esports. So if the smart contracts were there, it could say, okay, if you're on this website and your team is listed as number one, when the tournament finishes, the payment is auto-released to you. And that's all publicly on the blockchain. And then they just stake the money. And then whoever's doing it, you know, kind of that third party, they just take some sort of rake from that. Then perfect. The money gets paid out instantly. Happens all the time. It happens in every sport. It happened recently with Oman's cricket team with the last World Cup.
Mm.
Big thing. They didn't pay out their money to their players. So the difference between that and AI is already here. There are some great proof of concepts, but it's actually things that you can use and can be an advantage to you. So like one example of that is I did for one business I work with, which is Limitless. So we're the largest Counter-Strike map creator in the world. We've got a Guinness World Record of having the most followers on the Steam community. We've got about 2.5x compared to anyone else on there. with Limitless, I needed to increase our top of funnel sales. So that means that I need to get the word out there to more people that we exist, because it's pretty niche, right? Like a company that makes Counter-Strike maps. And there's honestly no one else in the space that's professional like us. We are the only one in that space that's doing this. So it's really hard to start a market because brands are like, who the fuck are you and what do you do? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So we need to increase our top funnel. So to get people to give us money, it's much more likely if they already give money to Counter-Strike. So I used ChatGPT to find for me the top 50 ranked teams in Counter-Strike and all of their sponsors and where to contact them. I did that. You know, that would probably take me about 3 days manually. I did it in about 4.5 hours. And it doesn't do all of it. I can't just say that to it and then it just all goes.
Yeah.
But it does a lot of first off is find me the top 50 teams and list them in a list that I can copy paste into Excel. Done. Mm-hmm. And then it's, you know, there's a lot more kind of steps to it. But still, it automated most of that workflow. Some other practical examples is that when we create content, we don't use gimbals, we don't use DSLR cameras anymore. And a lot of the time we don't use microphones. We use AI to do that. So we use AI to upscale and smooth and heighten the FPS. So we also shoot in 30 FPS on a phone. Say it like PAX at an event. Mm-hmm. So I shoot 30 FPS on a phone. We use Topaz.ai to smooth it. So we don't need a gimbal. We also use it to upscale it. So it increases the resolution and the frame rate. And we also use Topaz to clean the audio as well. So if we use a mic or we don't use a mic. So, you know, when we're doing that stuff, we don't need to buy a $300 gimbal. I don't need to have a DSLR. I don't need to have any professional people I'm paying to do any of this kind of stuff for the editing as well. It's done in CapCut on a mobile phone. So we could do all of that just off a phone now, which is saving us real money and real time in doing all those kind of things too. So there's so many things right now in AI that are, you need to chain them together yourself with a bit of work, but it will decrease your workload or increase your output capacity by 30 to 60% quite easily if you've got the right tools at your disposal, like that kind of stuff. Or there's other ones that, say for your podcast, for example, Minvo.pro is one I've used before, which just cuts podcasts up into clips, auto puts captions on them with emojis on them. Boom, done.
Yep.
I did it for a potential client of ours in the gambling space. I was like, bro, you should just use, you know, a lot of gambling companies are really struggling because their cost of marketing is way too high. That's really, and also the taxes are really eating into them. So I was like, well, instead of paying an editor, you know, I used to pay an editor $100 to edit the ums out of a podcast. You can now do that with an automatic tool in like 5 seconds. 20 seconds and pay it $20 a month and then do 5 podcasts a month and things like that too. Or you can use Minvo to cut up clips and things like that too, rather than paying $30 a clip to an editor. You can automate that. And instead of paying $30 per clip for an editor to do 3 clips in a week, you can pay $30 a month to do 20 clips in a day of one podcast and then increase that too. So that's four or five real life examples of the way we use AI at least every day or every week or every month to save us a lot of time. And most of that's done through a $20 a month ChatGPT 4.0 subscription, which is what we primarily use at the moment.
Yeah, crazy. It's definitely, I always think back, because I've started using quite a bit recently, and I think back to like 10 years ago, and I was like, damn, if only I had like something like chat now. And I'm just thinking, what happens in the next 10 years? You know, how advanced does it get? I think that's the exciting part as well.
Yeah, well, like AI coaching tools, so like Rankasy in the Counter-Strike space, for example, you know, they are synthesizing millions of demos or thousands or hundreds of thousands of rounds in Counter-Strike to say, like, you know, like when I was, you know, like using critical thinking when I was trying to learn how to play Counter-Strike better. So like on Dust 2 on default on T-side, I would do what Zist did for Fnatic or NIP and / Fnatic at the time, which is I would go like uppers B to lowers B, clear short, and then pre-fire mid to get the AWPer off the line. And then we could decide what we wanted to do after that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, trying to teach other people what I would do is that critical thinking of why is he pre-firing there? Which corners does he aim at first and why? Which corners does he primarily skip? If he threw a grenade, why did he throw that grenade? You know, if he threw a grenade short, why did he not throw one last round? He threw one this round.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's likely a reason why those things are happening. So trying to take that critical thinking. But if it can use AI to do that, it can summarize your demos and say, look, whenever you're retaking, you know, like whenever you're on CT side and the T's are planted the bomb and you're retaking B on Dust 2, you should send one window, one doors, one tunnels, because that will win 75% of the time. That will be, because that's the thing I went through in my brain all the time. It feels like tunnels are shit, but is it? I don't know. Another example is the OpenAI 5 that OpenAI made with Dota, and they beat OG after they won the TI. So they were all AIs that beat it, and it, you know, set new metas where,
crazy,
you know, you would basically never buy back with it unless it was very specific situations in Dota 2, and they bought back all the time to try to get in the game as soon as possible. So, you know, when they die, they lose money, they buy back. But, you know, I guess its calculations were, well, being in the game and having less money is better than not being in the game and having more money and things like that too. So it can help you to set new metas and to play better and to make better decisions over that period of time. So, you know, that's an esports specific example for you.
Crazy. Yeah. I think most recently I've definitely talked with a few researchers in esports space, and even using AI to sort of help understand protocols, mental protocols, warm-up protocols, physical protocols to a certain perspective, I think just helps to set even just a baseline foundation for players, for anyone really looking to, you know, improve their general health and well-being. So I think that the prevalence of AI is a lot of people are resistant to it, but I think once they start using it for the first time and understanding, hey, this is actually pretty cool, that's when they start opening up to it a bit and thinking, hey, maybe I can have a bit of real life application towards it.
Yeah, one of the things I'm really good at and have been for a long time, especially my LinkedIn content, is taking an entire industry and helping to boil down what's happening in the industry and how it relates to the person or the people that I'm talking to.
Mm.
And that's something that AI is great at. Like, if you can learn who you are and can learn what you're trying to achieve, like with that Counter-Strike example of where you should, you know, when you've got a one versus X or an X versus X, this is what you should do in that situation. You don't need to make that decision by watching thousands of demos. It'll watch thousands of demos for you and then help you to make that informed decision at what the best, you know, high percentage play is for you to do. And it can do that in multiple different ways. And it's not going to, you know, once again, it's not going to play the game for you. It's not going to put the hours into aim practice. It's not going to throw the grenades. It's not going to choose your setup and what your mouse should be in sensitivity, but it's going to help with those things that will help, you know, in specific ways of that thinking that you wouldn't get otherwise.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's incredible. And I'm really excited to see where we sort of go. Now, obviously your current role with Big R, I'm happy to give you a little bit of a spotlight here to sort of promote it and sort of talk about what you're doing at Big R and, you know, all the good stuff you're doing there, which would be awesome. All the listeners, I'm sure, would be delighted to hear about.
Sure, man. So taking the AI thinking of like what I talked about before with, you know, how do we automate processes? So we sat down, you know, he was kind of my right-hand man at the time and is now my business partner and my co-founder with Bax. And we sat down and asked the question, how do we turn ourselves into AI? That was around the explosion time of ChatGPT, like late 2022. And we're thinking about, you know, what are the processes that we have? Can we build a flowchart to automate those processes? So one of the good ideas, you know, we had a bunch of shitty ideas and then some okay ideas, but one of the good ideas was taking what I talked about before, which is how do I automate what I do on LinkedIn, which is for every single person in the world, how do we have, say, a morning president's briefing where you can log online and it'll say, here's what's happened in your life, here's what's happening in your industry, and here's how it relates to you. That's far too big of a project. That's fucking complex, but I still think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
So we looked at it a bit more granularly and we looked at socials. So as an agency, we would charge a client $5,500 US a month to run their socials at around a 30% margin. And to create a strategy for that client would take 2 or 3 days kind of staff time. And then it would take a staff maybe 0.4 of, you know, if one is their full-time job, it might take them about 0.4 to half, so sometimes 0.6 to manage that client. So that means that we're making barely any money. The client's paying us a lot of money, you know, $5,500 is a lot of money, especially for a smaller business. And that means it's just pretty shit overall. So like, you know, and there's also a high chance of it not succeeding. So a high chance of the client being annoyed as well and it not working. So that sounds pretty risk heavy and also no one wins in that situation. So
yeah,
we managed to build a product that can completely automate social media for small to medium businesses by using an app that you can download off the app store. So when you download the app, you connect your website. You put in your website and you connect your meta to it. It builds it's called a RAG, but essentially it's a database on you. It reads your website, understands who you are. If you're a cafe, it'll download your menu and understands what products you sell at what price and what the ingredients in those products are. So it informs itself on the business like a social media manager would, creates a strategy for you based off that. How many times per week should you post on what platform and at what time?
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll create the content for you, send it to you for approvals. We allow you to do 4 posts per week. 2 posts in advance, and it'll make 4 options per post. So the maths is 4 by 4 by 4, which is 32. So it'll make 32 bits of content for you each week. And then you can approve them and do some slight edits and just push them out. And we can do that at a much better margin for $100 a month. So, you know, essentially, it's a slightly lower level to the last social stuff I talked about we do as an agency. But, you know, a person would charge $850 a week to do this as a consultant, and we do it for $30 a week or thereabouts, take, you know, depending on how many weeks there are in a month in any given month.
Yeah, a lot more lower entry cost, but a lot more expandable in terms of the reach you can have.
Yeah, you know, one of our investors is a YouTuber. He owns a cafe. There's no way he could afford to hire an agency for $5,500 a month, even though he's packed and he's busy and he does really well. You know, have some insights into his finances and how that kind of stuff works and their margins, especially the cost of living and the cost of ingredients going up a lot too. Like, there's just zero chance you could afford to do that. But $100 a month, you know, that's a different story.
Yeah, I think that where did that idea come from, I guess, from your perspective? Was it, I can sort of collaborate with my previous colleagues on this idea? Was it, you know, where did it come from that perspective? And how long did it take from idea to creation? Just for anyone listening that's interested in building their own sort of, you know, AI-based project.
Yeah, so we soft launched in September 2024. We started looking for an idea in late October 2022. Mm-hmm. We raised money in the end of 2023, like around December 2023. So mm-hmm. started looking for an idea. A year later, we landed our round. And then 9 months later, we launched our product. But it really depends, you know, what you're trying to do. I think we could have probably done it a bit faster, but it was such a new industry too. It's so hard to know. And there's always so many learnings you have, you know, like, you know, we're looking at other business opportunities and ideas at the moment. There's a lot of learnings from this. Like, maybe we should have created something that's a bit more for our industry that we're used to. You know, we haven't worked with a lot of small businesses in the past, but it was yeah. too good of an opportunity to pass up to come up with this idea. So there's some winnings and there's some learnings and there's some failures that come with all this kind of business stuff. Similar to like the Shade Crew one that I talked about that we did. You know, we had a influencer house, tried to make kind of like a phase clean house in Melbourne.
Yep.
Most of the talent were traditional kind of influencer talent. And the thing that brought them all together was gaming. You know, mm-hmm. some were photographers. We had a cosplayer. We had a few, like, we had people in Australia probably know, like, the Angry Dad Boys. We had them as part of it as well. We had Shane Warne's son, Jackson Warne, as part of it. But we also had some pure gamers. I mean, the cosplayer was a gaming cosplayer. But we also had Astro Kitty, Overwatch YouTuber with over 100K subscribers and people like that too. But, you know, so many learnings from all that kind of stuff, you know, right place, right time or wrong place, right time or all that kind of stuff that you learn.
Yeah.
You know, how to raise money better in the future, you know, who to take money from, who not to take money from, who to do business with, who not. Mm-hmm. And for me too, like I'd never built a product before. I've launched other people's products a lot. And launched other people's physical stuff and also launched, you know, information like launched podcasts and launched events and that kind of stuff too. But a product's very different because you're tied to the engineering yep. of it. And people's emotions and how you onboard people. And we went extremely seriously into the UX UI and onboarding experience for us, which was what we should have done. But that was a guess that we should have done that.
Mm.
And there are other things that we didn't really work out that we spent time on. Yeah. So yeah, there's so many learnings from that. And you get some, you get some good investors, you get some bad investors. I don't think I've ever had a really bad investor. I've had some which have been maybe a little bit annoying in the past, but, mm-hmm. Have definitely had that experience with friends taking bad investors. For sure. I've got one friend who we would both know that I won't talk about, but you know, he took two rounds of bad investors. So I feel really sorry for him. He learned a lot off that. So you need to either learn off your own failings or other people's failings for sure. About other businesses that, you know, a great learning is, you know, money isn't as cheap as it was over COVID, especially when there was a 0% interest rate, right? And money was just falling out of the sky for everyone. And now we're paying for that. But, you know, a very common thing in that time too was delay launching a product as much as possible to build hype.
Nice.
But the problem is that if you haven't launched it, you don't know if anyone's going to actually pay for it. Mm. So we had a client of ours who raised a shitload of money and burnt a lot of it before they finally released their product and realized that what people get for free in the beta, they ain't going to pay.
Yep.
So if they launched that product, even if it was nowhere near as good as it was, because they were very, prideful of their branding, like yep. to a fault, and how their product looked and how it was positioned and how it, you know, everything around that ecosystem, which you obviously need that in a way, but they were too like purist with it.
Micro niches, yeah.
Yeah, they were far too purist with the micro niche of like, oh, we need to update the font in our directory where like, no, you need to like make some wide sweeping changes. Like, you know, like you need to make some big plays here, not just like these tiny little, yeah. you know, enhancements to get one better FPS out of a certain thing and, you know, that kind of stuff. And yeah, they just waited too long to release a product and then everyone was like, nah, I'm paying for that.
Mm.
Like there's no way all that much or in its current format or something, you know, there was
crazy
different opinions as to why, but the cold hard fact was they ain't paying for it. So
easy. Wow. And I guess, yeah, I think it's pivotal that you sort of mentioned it, like the experience that you learned over time from, I guess, pushing your own product, you know, that's invaluable within itself. And I guess can help with upcoming projects, future projects. And I guess taking that from a, I guess, developmental prospect can really help enrich that whole process for sure.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, like I'm always about hands-on learning, about doing this stuff, you know, and probably to a fault sometimes. But it's, you know, it's the way that I enjoy doing that stuff. I know what it's like to pitch a journalist and to be a freelance journalist, doing 10 news articles a day before lunch and also doing reviews on the side and not getting paid that well to do it, which is the reality of journalism today is that they're so overworked, they're understaffed and they're paid fuck all to do it. But you understand what it's like from being in those shoes. I understand what it's like being a PR and marketing manager at Corsair, understand, you know, for a US company, understand what it's like being an esports and community manager for Thermaltake, which is a Taiwanese company. So different. So different. And understand what it's like working in that tech channel space where your all of their HQs are out of Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And if they're a East Taiwanese HQ, it's very different, just those cultures. Like working for that US company of Corsair, that US culture bled into Taiwan, and the Taiwanese office is nothing like the Taiwanese office of, say, Intel or NVIDIA, who are also US companies. They're very, very different. You know, NVIDIA's Taiwanese office is very Taiwanese cultured, in my opinion, whereas Corsair's Taiwanese office is very American cultured, in my opinion, whereas Thermaltake is headquarters out of Taiwan. So, of course, it's Taiwan cultured. And just the way that they see branding and product management and pricing and margins is just so different between them. You know, Corsair is much of a lower amount of units, higher cost, higher margin with better branding type deal. And one of the reasons I took the job is I went to their website and just look at the website. Like, look at Thermaltake's website versus Corsair's website, and they'll tell you straight away what type of company they are. Whereas Thermaltake is often, sometimes, of course, they've got flagship products that have a higher margin, a higher cost, but primarily they're a cheaper product mover at a lower margin. So they're releasing keyboards that are, you know, in the $80 to $140 realm, where Corsair are releasing keyboards that are in the $100 to $250 realm. And, you know, the quality of the packaging you can see is different, and the R&D is different that goes into that. So, you know, even those two companies that are so alike, like in the products they sell with Corsair and Thermaltake, they both do case, cooler, power supply, keyboard, mouse, mousepad, headset. Yeah. They sell to the same people. They're just so fundamentally different in so many ways. So it's good to get hands-on. And that helps when you're in the king of industry, which is sales, because you know the temperament of the people you're selling to. I know that when I'm selling to a Taiwanese company, what they're going to expect. Lower budgets, more logos, and different types of ways of communicating, whereas Corsair is going to expect different kinds of things. You know, a very common Taiwanese thing is they love logo slapping. They really do. And they just want logos and a lot of stuff. And that's really what's important to them. But also, they're not going to pay as much as some other ones, whereas American companies are like, ah, we'll take the risk. We've got some slush fund budget. Where, yeah, two very different types of cultures of business.
Interesting. I love that insight. Definitely an insight that I hadn't even thought about, to be honest, in terms of the micro niches of the industry, right? Which I think a lot of people will value.
Like from your place perspective too, from, you know, talking to Dexter quite a lot recently, like we've only just become friends, I would say, but we talk fairly regularly.
Yeah.
I found it really interesting talking to him about, he's played for different teams in different regions. What's the culture like? In those teams, and so different, it's exceptionally different. Like play as a player for Mouz versus Fnatic, who are both European organizations, very different culture playing for those two things. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Like, not for me to comment, but, you know, different, very different ways of doing business, but two successful businesses. And same with Thermaltake and Corsair, both like multi-billion-dollar businesses, but exceptionally different ways of selling similar products to the same audience.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Really, really interesting insight. I love it. Just looking at the time as we sort of roll down the hill now towards the end, obviously so much, probably, yeah, a lot more insight than I even would have expected. So I really appreciate it, mate, in terms of the insight that you would have given a lot of people listening, just the insight into your industry, insight into your mind, I guess. That's what I'm likely to say. What I love to always ask, I guess, as an end key takeaway, if you had sort of some advice for someone young looking to get into esports or looking to get into the realm of gaming, I guess, as a whole, what advice would you give them from your perspective on where to go next?
Learn sales. And if you can do sales, do sales. Like, sales makes the world go around. And I used to run, when I first ever started doing my own stuff in this space, I did an esports course. It was kind of like I had a level 1, 2, and 3, basically, like how to get a job in this space. And I had a guy come up to me at an event in Melbourne recently. It was the Games Expo, TGX. And he came up to me and said, Chris, I did your level 2 course, like, fuck, I don't know, it's like 10 years ago. And he's like, you know, you told me back then that I should look more into sales, didn't take it seriously. Now I have, and it's opened my eyes incredibly to what goes on. You know, nothing else, they earn the most money, but you just get such a good insight into everything that's going on. You know how much things cost, you know what margins are, you know the decision makers, who to talk to. You also get the most opportunities for travel and to get to things. And it's not for everyone, it takes a certain temperament. But you can also sell so differently. You know, I've got two friends One's an investor of mine, and one's just a long-term friend of mine, who've both done $100 million in sales in their lifetime USD, wow. And they sell completely the opposite. One's Jeff Pabst, who I've done podcasts with from FaZe, who's done $100 million in sales. I'm much more like him, relationship-based, friendly, et cetera. One of my other investors, who's done $100 million in sales, primarily around like the video game space, very direct, exceptionally direct.
Wow. Yeah.
And he's much more likely to wear a suit than I am. He's much more likely to ask a direct question. And in many ways, that's a less stressful way to do business, because in sales, you want to get to a no as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want someone to either say yes or no, and then you can move on to the next person. You don't want to do what I did when I almost killed my agency and taken like 8 months to get to a no, because you've spent 8 months of salaries to then earn fucking nothing right. In the end. Yeah. They tell you no in 10 minutes, then you know, you're not going to fuck around. And you know, for anyone else, it's the same. Say we're getting a girlfriend, right? Like if they're just going to tell you to fuck off and then you just fuck off, well, then you can just go and try to find someone else, right? But if someone leads you on for 8 months and then they tell you to fuck off, you're like, okay, did I ever have a chance? And they're like, no, actually. And you're like, well, that's 8 months wasted.
So, what a prime example.
Exactly. It can be exactly the same thing. So yeah, sales makes the world go round, and always like just get your hands dirty and find a way. For me, like I talked about at the start with NetGame Radio, I started as a volunteer and I just kept asking for more stuff.
Yep.
Give me more. Can I do more? And then just learnt so many things hands on and now have that perspective. But, I mean, sales could be very hard, obviously, and it's performance based, obviously, but you're, as an entrepreneur or even as a business person, you're always selling. Like if you're trying to get a job doing night fill at Coles or at Walmart, you're selling yourself. Like, you know, you're saying you should pick me because of ABC reason. That's it. You're selling yourself. You're selling your services, which is you. If you're trying to get investment from an investor, you're selling yourself. This is my story. This is why my team is the right people to do this. This is why this opportunity is something that you should believe in. You know, this is what I believe in. You should too. You're selling that. If you're doing marketing, you're selling a story. So there's a common thing, which I did always agree with. I thought was funny. Like in Corsair, someone told me that in Corsair or somewhere else, but sales makes the money, marketing spends the money.
Yeah.
And whether it's right or wrong, that's how every business sees it. Because that's, you know, literally that's what happens, but probably not in reality, because marketing is the one that, you know, is that creates the demand for the products, right?
Yep.
But that's also the way that it's treated as well. So, you know, seeing how sales teams are treated versus marketing teams is very funny in certain businesses, with the differences between like Harry Potter under the stairs. That's for marketing. Versus sales, like cruising on yachts and like literally
splashing
cruising on yachts and hot air balloons and you know, 5-star resort getaways, where marketing is like, yeah, we're going to pile 30 of you into this room and just give you presentations all day and you're going to have hated fucking Jimmy John's.
Crazy.
That's always funny. But yeah, get your hands dirty, find some stuff and post on LinkedIn and don't be scared to ask questions with people. People will reply. That's how I had the CEO of Atari on my podcast, Jeff Pabst, Clinton Sparks, you know, pro Dota players like Loader, PPD, who won the international with EG, all these kind of people came on my podcast just because I had one and because I asked. So yeah, don't be scared to just ask people questions, and it's, you know, they might tell you to fuck off or they might reply. Who cares if they tell you to fuck off? Just go ask someone else. So yeah.
Legendary. Really appreciate it, Chris. I'm sure that a lot of people really value that insight, and I guess maybe even motivate them to take the next step in their journey, whether it be esports, whether it be gaming, whether it be whatever they're doing. I'm sure that there'll be a lot of, yeah, meaningful advice that you shared to them. So really, really do appreciate it. For everyone listening, where can we find you on socials, or where can we connect with you if you want to follow some of your content?
Sure, man. So probably LinkedIn is one of the best ways. So the LinkedIn URLs is like LinkedIn/IN/SmithyMayo.
Yep.
So obviously my last name, my gamer name, and then probably Instagram as well, which is Smithy Mayo, not on Twitter or X anywhere near as much these days. But yeah, that's where you'll find me across the stuff I'm doing, across Bigger and Limitless and any of the other consultancy.
Legendary. Where does the Mayo come from?
A long story, but in Battlefield, I was the Muffin Man Yo. So it's, I'm trying to think like the easiest way. And it had some numbers in there too, some lead speak. So it was like T3H for the, and then Muffin, and then M4N Yo. And I put Yo in the end because I had Battlefield 2 beta and I had the Muffin Man and I forgot the password. So I put Yo in the end because I had an American friend at that time and I thought it was so cool that someone said Yo that I knew. And there were some capitals in there too. So the T was a capital and the M was a capital for M4N. So then I played in like my first ever proper tournament there. It was called the NetGam Radio Masters Tournament. I played with Team Renegade. I think it was like 10 grand in prizes or something. Dickens Cider was one of the sponsors, like legitimately. It's a cider company. And an energy mint company called Foosh. Fuck, they were disgusting. I used to give them away at LANs. They tasted so bad. And a bunch of others too. And the commentators just couldn't pronounce my name. They'll call me the Muffin Mayo, the Muffin Man Mayo, the Muffin Mayno. Probably because I made it fucking impossible for him to understand it. So, yeah, and I always wanted a shorter name. And especially when I switched to Counter-Strike, like short names were cool. I used to be so like in awe about reading on GOT Games, the lineups of the teams that were playing. And it's like, you know, it's like Sponge and Sniper and Havoc. I'm like, these are cool. These are like 1 to 2 syllable names. They're really short. Like, that's awesome. I want that. Yeah. So I made Mayo off the back of that. So it's got nothing to do with mayonnaise, although it's all right, okay. I guess. And it's just kind of the name that I've stuck with ever since. And then, yeah, got a bit of a story behind it, I guess.
Legendary. Appreciate that last insight. And yeah, appreciate the episode as a whole. I'm sure that everyone listening can find the links. I'll put all the links down in the description as well. And I'll, everyone will be able to find it on the website as well. But really appreciate you jumping on today, Chris, and sharing some insights about your trajectory, your story, your journey through esports. And I'm sure a lot of people can take away a lot of key things from that as well.
Yeah, no worries at all, brother. Good to be here.
Legendary. Thanks, mate.